We've been talking throughout this retreat about spiritual warfare. And I wanted to tell you about something that has a good deal to do with helping people with spiritual warfare. And that is a Dominican confraternity, which is called the Confraternity of the Angelic Warfare. What is this confraternity about? Thomas Aquinas, some of you I'm sure know that he is the patron saint of Catholic schools, lived in the Middle Ages, and his mother was related to the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So that meant that he was born into the high nobility. He was sent as a young man, actually a teenager, to study at the Benedictine Abbey of Monte Cassino, the one that was bombed during the Second World War. And he distinguished himself there as a person who was full of zeal for God, who said very little, and who thought a great deal. His parents would have been very happy if he had become the abbot of Monte Cassino, joined the Benedictine order, because that was a very powerful order at the time, and it was a very powerful abbey, and it was also very rich. Instead, St. Thomas, who was sent to the University of Naples to study, joined this outfit called the Dominicans. The Dominicans were very poor at the time. There were very few of them. They weren't known for a great deal, and they were like vagabonds almost, compared to the very powerful medieval abbeys. Needless to say, his mother was not amused by this decision. And so, when the superior tried to send him out of southern Italy, get away from his family, his brothers, who were knights, attacked the caravan, and they kidnapped him, and they took him to the family estate, and they imprisoned him there for 2 years, trying to get him to change his mind. His sister, who tried to convince him, was so enticed by his arguments about why he should enter the religious life and especially be a Dominican, that she actually helped him to escape and became an abbess of a Benedictine monastery later. Well, anyway, a part of their desire to try to tempt him away from his vocation was they introduced a prostitute into the room to try her wiles upon him, to tempt him sexually. And St. Thomas, in response to this, picked up a log from the fire and drove her out of the room, and then burned a cross on the back of the door with the log. And his canonization process relates that at that time he fell into a mystical experience, and he was girded with a cord of chastity by angels. This is called the angelic, that's why it's called the angelic warfare devotion. And he was never again tempted against chastity for the rest of his life. One of the things that characterized St. Thomas' life was his purity. Now, the Dominicans, in honor of this incident, founded in the 1720s a confraternity, people who were considered to be in some ways participating in the works of our order, which involves either the wearing of a cord or a medal, in which a person who wishes to experience chastity in their life, and these could be married people, single people, religious or priests, pray to the intercession of St. Thomas in order to do that. This is called the angelic warfare. The obligations of the members of this confraternity are to guard holy purity, to seek the truth, to honor Our Lady of the Rosary under the patronage of St. Thomas, to have your name enrolled in an official register, and to wear either the cord or the medal. The popes, in the centuries since this occurred, have heaped this confraternity with many indulgences. A person receives a plenary indulgence on the day they are enrolled. Every year on the feasts of Christmas, Easter, St. Thomas, the Annunciation, the Assumption, and All Saints' Day. The members gain a plenary indulgence on these days if they, of course, observe the conditions, which is to receive Holy Communion on that day with the intention of gaining the indulgence, go to the penance within 8 days before or after, pray of Our Father, Hail Mary, and Apostles' Creed for the intention of the Holy Father, and also renew privately the intention to live according to the practices and statutes of the confraternity. What I would like to do is just give you a brief discussion tonight of what is involved in the chastity which this confraternity seeks to promote. And also, after we have the procession of benediction, before we leave here, if any of you wish to be enrolled, we have helpful packets with the cord or the medal, and also a pamphlet, which I wrote a long time ago on this subject. And then there's a paper in there that you need to sign in order that you can be enrolled. The sisters will send the paper to the place where the enrollment takes place. So first of all, let's talk a teeny bit about chastity, because for many of us, the spiritual warfare involves this virtue. Man, as you know, was created in the image and likeness of God, and the principal source of this likeness is his soul. The soul is a spirit which is completely integrated with the body. As I explained to you, when Adam and Eve first experienced themselves sexually, the reason this occurred was so that they might learn to give of themselves to another, because they have a soul. Adam, if you remember, named all the animals, but he didn't find one like himself. And God says it's not good for man to be alone. Why is it not good for man to be alone? Because God isn't alone. God is a trinity of persons that spend all of eternity doing nothing but giving and receiving in interpersonal communion and love. So deep is this interpersonal communion that though, as you know, the Holy Trinity, the persons have to be distinct, they are all totally involved in each other. So much so that they form one nature, the infinite and eternal God. If man can't experience a communion of persons with people like himself, it's not possible for man to experience a communion, the full fulfillment of what it means to be a person after the image of God. So from Adam's rib, God creates Eve. When Adam sees Eve, John Paul II says that man utters the first great cry of joy in the history of the human race. And he says, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. And then as he has named the animals, he names her. She shall be called woman because she has been taken out of man. And Eve accepts this naming to show that she realizes she is a person too, and she gives herself back to Adam in personal communion. Before the sin, this relationship was characterized by nothing but gift and reception. In fact, it's stated, John Paul II makes a great deal of this verse, they were naked and not ashamed. Why were they naked and not ashamed? Because their bodies were for them, including their sexuality, a means by which they gave the gift of themselves to the other. In other words, they first experienced a communion of soul in heart, so that they became one in knowledge and love, and then they ratified this through the gift of the seed in the body. That's why, even before we had the sacrament of marriage in the New Testament, it's wrong to divorce your wife. It's also wrong to practice this giving of the seed if there's no personal commitment, which is lifelong. Marriage is a natural sacrament, and divorce is a natural evil. That's what the Catechism says. In fact, remember, when Jesus was asked the question about divorce, he quoted the book of Genesis, and St. Paul quotes the book of Genesis too. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. In other words, the reason sexuality exists is for the sake of allowing a person to give themselves to another without fear, without power, without extortion, without manipulation. Now, of course, that all depends on grace. They received that gift because they had grace. As soon as they lost grace, remember, they became naked and ashamed. God even calls to Adam, and Adam hides himself. And he says, I was naked and ashamed, so I hid myself. And God said to you, okay, who told you you were naked? Have you been eating the fruit of the tree I told you not to eat of? And what happens then? The relationship which was giving and receiving becomes one of mutual manipulation and domination. God, remember, says to the woman, as a punishment for the sin, your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, what does that mean? That means where before the sin, Adam and Eve, they did have a relationship of order, man to woman, but it was of wise governor to free citizen based on love and respect. After the sin becomes mutual competition to have power over each other. Man does this by force. Woman does this by trickery, by manipulation. Neither one is free totally to give themselves to the other because they're afraid of having the gift of themselves taken from the other by some sort of trick or device or force or power. And this is where shame enters the human race. Is the body something we're ashamed of because these atom molecules are bad or wrong or something like that? Of course not. God made the body. He didn't make any mistakes. The body of man is a good thing. It's a beautiful thing. Artists have represented it even naked, like David, making it a beautiful thing. Other people represent its nakedness in pornographic senses by trying to stimulate extortion, manipulation, people just trying to satisfy their feelings and their pleasure to make you an object instead of a subject to which to give yourself. Now, as a result, the relationship between man and woman is happy and holy if it returns or seeks to return to the gift of self, which was the original meaning of this action, the sexual action, the marital action. When Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, talks of the man who looks lustfully, he's talking about someone who regards someone else as an object of use for the sake of their own pleasure. In other words, I'm saying, you're good because you exist. The person says, you're good because you make me feel good. And the minute I don't feel good when I'm around you, you're not good. There's no nod given at all to the fact that this person is an individual, regardless of my feelings, that's a person and should call forth from me approval and love. Now, Jesus says this not because he wants to convict us of evil, but John Paul II says he says this because he wants to say that in the sin, the body is not a sufficiently appreciated good. Because the reason it exists, we have to recover it. We have to redeem it, as Romans 8 says, to recover the ability of the body to give the gift of self again. And also, if a person gives the gift of themselves in marriage, it's free. And as a result of the New Testament, they can also realize this gift of themselves by choosing not to do so after the manner of this world. In other words, in priestly life or in religious life, they can choose to do this by giving their chastity completely to God, as we do when we renounce all sexual relations. But we don't do that because we think the body's evil. People think we do that because we think the body's evil, or we couldn't get married, or something like that. At this seminary where I teach, we used to have this nun who was an academic dean, our Sister Mary. And I have met many religious women, thousands of religious women. I'd never met anyone quite like our Sister Mary. And when the seminarians were going home on vacation, she used to give them this pep talk. Now remember, a lot of these people are widowers, they're elderly, they've been married, they have kids. Her pep talk went something like this. Now boys, when you go home on vacation, don't go out with the women. You tried that once and you're not good at it. That's the reason you're here. Now I'm sorry, that's exactly the opposite reason from the reason the church gives why we're here. It's because we appreciate the giving of self in marriage, but we believe God has called us to give ourselves in a deeper way. And that's why the church is very clear on the fact that the invitation to virginity, which is always considered to be a higher life than marriage, but is in no sense a denigration of marriage. We don't embrace this because we think marriage is evil or the body's evil. We embrace this because we love all the things of the body. We understand them. We know what they're about. But we've chosen to renounce them for the sake of something better, of being with God always. Now, in our life of concupiscence, in our life of weakness, we struggle to return to this experience of the redemption of our bodies. We struggle to return to this experience where we, who have been called to chastity, which is perpetual, can live this joyously and freely. For some, it's a great struggle. We also struggle in our married life or in our single life to learn what it means to give oneself disinterestedly to another. In other words, I love you because you exist, not because you make me feel good. To be does not mean to be in competition. This is very well beautifully expressed, and I hope you'll bear with me for a minute. I can see some of you are falling asleep. I hope you'll bear with me for a minute in this beautiful letter by C.S. Lewis, again, in the Screwtape Letters, on the nature of sexuality. Remember, this is a junior tempter on earth being instructed by a senior tempter in hell. My dear Wormwood, even under slub gob, you must have learned at college the routine technique of sexual temptation. And since for us spirits, this whole subject is one of considerable tedium, because obviously the angels don't have bodies, so what do they care about sexual temptation? It means nothing to them. Though necessary as a part of our training, I will pass it over. But on the larger issues, I think you have a good deal to learn. The enemies, remember that's God's demand on humans, takes the form of a dilemma, either complete abstinence or unmitigated monogamy. Ever since our father's first great victory, which would be what? The original sin, right? The devil's first great victory. We have rendered the former very difficult for them. The latter, for the last few centuries, we've been closing up as a way of escape. We've done this with the poets and the novelists by persuading the humans that a curious and short-lived experience, which they call being in love, is the only respectable ground for marriage. That marriage can and ought to render this excitement permanent, and that a marriage which does not do so is no longer binding. This idea is our parody of an idea that came from the enemy. The whole philosophy of hell rests on the recognition of the axiom that one thing is not another thing, and especially oneself is not another self. My good is my good, your good is yours. What one gains, another loses. Even an inanimate object is what it is by excluding all other objects from the space it occupies. If it expands, it does so by thrusting all the other objects out of the way or by absorbing them. A self does the same. With beasts, the absorption takes the form of eating. For us, it means sucking the will and freedom out of a weaker self into a stronger. To be means to be in competition. Now, the enemy's philosophy is nothing more nor less than one continued attempt to evade this obvious truth. He aims at a contradiction. Things are to be many, yet somehow also one. The good of oneself is to be the good of another. This impossibility he calls love. And this same monotonous panacea can be detected under all he does or even all he is or claims to be. Thus, he is not content even himself to be a sheer arithmetical unity. He claims to be three as well as one, the Trinity, in order that this nonsense about love might find a foothold in his own nature. At the other end of the scale, he introduces into the matter that obscene invention, the organism, in which the parts are perverted from their natural destiny of competition and made to cooperate. His real motive for fixing on sex as a method of reproduction among humans is all too apparent from the use he has made of it. Sex might have been, from our point of view, quite innocent. It might have been merely one more mode in which a stronger self preyed upon a weaker, as it is among the spiders, where the bride concludes her marriage banquet by eating the groom, you know, the black widow. But in humans, the enemy has gratuitously associated affection between the parties with sexual desire. He's also made the offspring dependent on the parents and given the parents an impulse to support it, thus producing the family, which is like the organism, only worse. For the members are more distinct, yet also united in a more conscious and responsible way. The whole thing, in fact, turns out to be one more device for dragging in love. Now comes the joke. The enemy described a married couple as one flesh. He did not say happily married couple or a couple who married because they were in love. But you can make the humans ignore that. You can also make them forget that the man they called Paul did not confine it to married couples. Mere copulation for him makes one flesh. You can thus get the humans to accept as rhetorical eulogies of being in love what were in fact plain descriptions of the real significance of sexual intercourse. The truth is that wherever a man lies with a woman, there, whether they like it or not, a transcendental relationship is set up between them, which must be eternally enjoyed or eternally endured. Now, dear brothers and sisters in Christ, to recover this idea where we give ourselves completely in our chastity, whether it's within marriage or single life or potentially married life or the religious life of the priesthood, this confraternity exists. We know that many of us have a tendency to weakness in this regard. Lord knows, the woods are full today of men, especially devout Christian men, experience a lot of problems with images on the internet that some of them are almost addicted to, you could say. We're never in such need of returning to a correct vision of what's involved in the sexual order as in our present society, where, as you know, anything goes. We're now having gay marriage. We're having wholesale contraception that the people are trying to force us to pay for. The whole institution of marriage and the family is completely attacked in our society today. When I wrote this little pamphlet, I thought, well, what better thing could the end of the 20th century and 21st century benefit from than desire for chastity coupled with truth, with devotion for St. Thomas? And so I offer this to you today, if you're interested, to help you to experience this integration in you again. There's been many testimonies in the revival of this confraternity. I haven't done too much with it, but there's a priest in the Eastern Province in Washington, D.C., who's done a great deal with it, of people who had difficulties in this regard, and because of their prayers to St. Thomas, have experienced great release from problems. So, in everything that we do, in the spiritual warfare, we must look to St. Thomas. You know, when St. Thomas, he had a vision of Christ on the cross. And Christ said to him, Thomas, what reward can I give you for all you've written about me? And St. Thomas answered, Non nisi te domine, which is his motto. What reward do I want? Nothing but you, O Lord. So now we'll have the procession and then benediction, and I will not leave at the end of benediction to sing Holy God, We Praise Thy Name until after we've enrolled people in the confraternity who wish to be.